Today is Tuesday, June 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Is time running out for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's tenure in office?
They have until late Wednesday night to go to the president.
Plus, Tulsa marks 100 years since America's deadliest race massacre.
It was a two-day event that started on May 31st, 1921. Thousands of black Tulsans fled a white mob that destroyed several churches while burning and leveling a 35-square-block neighborhood.
And using edutainment to build computer skills. We'll have these stories and more next. Hamas's top leader in the Gaza Strip expressed optimism about reaching a prisoner exchange with Israel. Those remarks came as Egyptian mediators were working to hammer out a long-term ceasefire following an 11-day conflict in the Gaza Strip. Israel's defense minister, Benny Gantz, says that any progress on post-war reconstruction in Gaza would hinge on Hamas releasing the remains of two dead Israeli soldiers as well as two Israeli civilians it was holding. Now, to get more details about the discussions taking place and more, I spoke with reporter Orly Halpern in Jerusalem.
A delegation of Egyptians, including the head of Egyptian intelligence, arrived in Gaza on Monday to spearhead talks about closing up the issues with ceasefire, the issues of the Israeli captives, reconstruction in Gaza, all of these subjects. And the head of Hamas in Gaza, Yahya Sinwar, said that he was willing to discuss the issue with Israel of returning the captives, the Israeli captives that are in Gaza. So from the point of view of Hamas, this is only possible if it is not connected to the other issues. In other words, Hamas does not want to negotiate a return over these Israeli citizens in exchange for the reconstruction in Gaza. Issues that are related to Gaza. They want to discuss the issue of the captives in exchange for Palestinians who are in Israeli prisons. So they want to make that separate. And until now, Israel has not been interested in doing that.
And the other thing that came up on Monday is this other Hamas official who said that if the ceasefire is to continue, Israel needed to stop aggression, not only in Gaza, but within Jerusalem. Can you give us more details on that?
Now Hamas is saying, we want you to not use aggressive police against the people in Jezreel, not to evict those people, not to use a very strong Israeli police presence on the Temple Mount. So it's going back to where we were a few weeks ago. And we'll see how Israel will react. We know that the U.S. Administration, the Biden administration, is very keen to have Israel lower its profile on these issues. And Israel is also not interested in reigniting the flame. So it's unlikely that Israel is going to start getting very aggressive on the Temple Mount. And the question remains, what will happen in the neighborhood of those Palestinian families?
Orly, one last question on a different matter, and this is about the government of Israel itself. On Sunday, it was announced that there may be a possible unity government being formed ahead of the Wednesday midnight deadline. And if that does come to pass, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu would find himself out of a job. What are the challenges that remain to more or less seal the deal and finally form a government after 2 years and four elections?
They have until late Wednesday night to go to the president and say, here, these people have signed on. We now have 61 seats, which is the minimum number of seats you have out of the 120 to form a coalition. Then after that, it goes to a vote in the Knesset. This gives Netanyahu still some time to try to convince at least one person to break off, one right-wing person to break off in this change government, and then the coalition will fall apart. So people expect him to try to keep pressing for the right-wing members of this coalition to leave, at least one. And once it goes for a vote in the Knesset, then that's it, and that is the new government. In the meantime, people are expecting a lot of pressure, and already there is a lot of pressure on the right-wing members of this coalition. In fact, just this evening, the Israeli Shin Bet, which is like the FBI, has put almost the top security on the two top members of one of the right-wing parties that is part of this coalition. Naftali Bennett and Ayala Shaked from the Yamina Party now have a lot of security on them for fear that right-wingers who support Netanyahu will harm them. 12 years of Netanyahu is a long time, and he has very strong supporters. If this coalition government is indeed formed, it'll be very interesting to see how it will function. It will be a rotation government with initially Naftali Bennett as prime minister. He's more right-wing than Netanyahu. This is a man who bragged about killing many Arabs when he was doing his military service. At the same time, there's going to be an Arab minister from the very left-wing Meretz party, and they're going to be sitting in the same government.
Orly Halpern was speaking to me from Jerusalem. Nigerian political observers are expressing concern over the many attacks on the facilities of Nigeria's electoral body. That's the Independent National Electoral Commission, or INEC. INEC officials say the commission has recorded at least 42 attacks on its facilities since the last polls in 2019. Timothy Obizu is up next.
9 attacks occurred in 2019 and 21 others took place last year. But in the last 4 weeks, 12 more offices of the commission have either been set ablaze or vandalized. The latest incident occurred Sunday in southeastern Imo State. Ballot boxes, voted cubicles, power generators, and utility vehicles were destroyed. Election officials are evaluating the extent of the damage, but say an initial assessment shows it could significantly affect their ability to conduct credible elections in the affected places. Political analysts like Jibrin Ibrahim, a senior fellow at the Center for Democracy and Development, agree that attacks on facilities, coupled with Nigeria's general security challenges and separatist calls in two areas, will affect polls.
When some people are saying we want out of the nation, others are saying, let's just vote and keep the nation. It becomes a difficult context to ensure that there's a level playing ground for elections.
Officials blame unidentified armed groups and the separatist group Indigenous People of Biafra, or IPOB, for the fresh attacks. IPOB advocates an independent state in a part of Nigeria that tried to break away more than 50 years ago. The government has not commented on the attacks. In recent months, Nigeria has seen an escalation in violence by armed criminal groups, as well as the rising profile of IPOB and another separatist movement in southwestern Nigeria. But political analyst Rotimi Olawale says insecurities can only delay elections, not hinder them.
And I'm assured that the 2023 general election would hold as scheduled. As you know, in 2019, the election was moved for a couple of weeks to allow for better management of the security architecture in the northeastern part of Nigeria. At the very worst case scenario, I suspect that the election in 2023 might also be moved for a few weeks.
Last week, INEC chief Mahmoud Yakubu declared attacks on election offices a national emergency and met with top security chiefs to address the problem. At a meeting Thursday, Nigerian security units pledged to support the commission by beefing up security around election offices. However, expert Ezinwanwabu says the attacks are politically driven and will likely escalate before the next polls.
Nigerian political elites are not innovative. They have not found any other means of negotiating for power except violence. Okay, and we are going to see that towards next year, there will be the escalation of violence.
INEC is approaching a major gubernatorial election set for this November. Next month, the commission will begin a voter registration process for Nigeria's general polls in 2023. Experts say the security situation will determine both turnout and the credibility of the process. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. In marking World No Tobacco Day, the World Health Organization is urging smokers to quit their habit. warning that they are at a higher risk of dying from COVID-19 than non-smokers. Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
Head of WHO's tobacco control program, Vinayak Prasad, tells VOA a plethora of scientific studies over the past year confirm smokers face a 50% higher risk of developing severe disease and death from COVID-19.
It's logical because smoking does affect lung function, and this virus does attack the lungs. So that's where the rationale for taking measures to not use tobacco.
The World Health Organization is urging smokers to join its year-long Quit Tobacco campaign, which helps countries scale up their tobacco control services. These include running national awareness campaigns, opening new cessation clinics, and offering nicotine replacement therapies. Prasad says it is of utmost importance to make users aware of the risks they run. He says some 8 million people will die prematurely this year from tobacco-related illnesses such as cancers, heart disease, and respiratory illnesses. Most of these deaths will occur in low-income countries. He notes it usually takes decades for these deadly illnesses to develop. Therefore, preventing young people from taking up this habit is essential, as they can lead to a lifelong addiction. He accuses the tobacco industry of targeting young people to get them hooked on their products by offering freebies such as tickets to concerts, nicotine pouches, and e-cigarettes. This, he says, has been met with success in many countries. For example, he notes 38% of Indonesia's teenage boys smoke.
Likewise, in European setting, for example, the girls, the women, tobacco use is so high that the male-to-female difference is no longer there. The industry is continuing to reap all of the benefits they can from this divide, getting more and more women to, and targeting the girl child, adolescents, and then continuing to push their products in developing countries.
WHO reports imposing substantial taxes on tobacco products is one of the most effective ways of getting smokers to quit. Other successful smoke reduction measures include a ban on advertisements and promotions, health warnings on tobacco products, and designating areas as smoke-free zones. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Turkish government is facing accusations of arming and funding militants in Syria. The allegations are just the latest by a mafia boss at a weekly YouTube broadcast. As Dorian Jones reports, the allegations are putting the Turkish president in an increasingly tight spot.
Çocuklarının yanında şehit edilen babalarının intikamını sizden alacağız.
That exiled mafia boss set up Peke on YouTube. Peke, who analysts say once enjoyed close ties to Turkey's rulers, started broadcasting weekly Sunday videos on a YouTube channel, alleging government misdeeds after he was forced to flee the country. Analyst Attila Yeşilada says the mafia boss has a growing audience.
It's huge. He is easily attracting audiences in excess of 4 to 5 million per video. And everything he says is scrutinized in the opposition channels. So I would say everyone knows about what he's saying. Obviously, the most damaging is him reopening the 1990 files, you know, the extrajudicial killings.
Peker alleges former Interior Minister Mehmet Ağar was the head of a shadowy organization known as the Deep State, which was responsible for a series of assassinations of prominent journalists dating back to the 1990s. Ağar is closely linked to Erdogan, and his son Tolga is a parliamentary deputy for the ruling AKP, Turkey's ruling party. Ağar has denied the allegations. Erol Önderoğlu of Reporters Without Borders says there is a need for government transparency.
This should be a part of a parliamentary inquiry first, but I think that it will never be possible without Turkish government naming some state actors in this period. So transparency today should ease, calm the public opinion, to show respect to the family victims.
But Erdogan is dismissing the allegations.
ülkemizde sağlanan bu huzur ve güven ikliminden duyulan
speaking to his deputies, the Turkish president claimed the accusations are part of an international conspiracy to oust him. But Peker's allegations continue, accusing the son of Erdogan's close confidant, former Prime Minister Binali Yildirim, of cocaine smuggling and turning Turkey into one of the biggest hubs for importing and distributing drugs into Europe. Yildirim dismissed the allegations. And let's point out, Erdogan is experienced at weathering political storms. But analyst Yeşilada says, unlike in the past, Turkey is in the midst of an economic crisis and record low opinion ratings for Erdogan.
These are all unmistakable signs of Armageddon for AKP and Erdogan approaching. It would really take a miracle to repair the reputational damage that's caused by Sedat Peker videos. The picture that emerges is that this is a government set up for personal benefit and for the benefit of cronies, and really has completely lost interest in the fate of the waters.
Peker is promising more YouTube videos that he says will share more intimate secrets he has learned from spending 2 decades in the inner circles of the ruling party. For this mafia boss, revenge is no longer a dish best served cold, but instead on a YouTube channel. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
According to the Danish state broadcaster DR, the U.S. National Security Agency used a partnership with Denmark's Foreign Intelligence Unit to spy on senior officials of neighboring countries, including German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Reuters reporter Emily Wither has those details.
The findings are the result of a 2015 internal investigation in the Danish Defense Intelligence Service into NSA's role in the partnership. It covered the period from 2012 to 2014 and said the NSA used Danish information cables to spy on senior officials in Sweden, Norway, France and Germany. DR cited 9 unnamed sources with access to the investigation. This isn't the first time allegations like this have emerged. In 2013, the US whistleblower Edward Snowden alleged tapping of the German Chancellor's phone by the NSA. The internal investigation in the Danish Defense Intelligence Service was launched in 2014 following these leaks about how the NSA works. The German government says it's following up on the report, while the Danish Defense Minister declined to comment on speculation about intelligence matters in the media. The media report said the NSA intercepted calls, text and chat messages to and from telephones of officials in the neighboring countries. In Washington, the NSA and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence declined to comment.
Reuters' Emily Wither. The AP's Mike Campen has more as the city of Tulsa, Oklahoma commemorates the 100th anniversary of the deadliest race massacre in American history.
It was a 2-day event that started on May 31st, 1921, in what came to be known as the Tulsa Race Massacre. Thousands of black Tulsans fled a white mob that destroyed several churches while burning and leveling a 35-square-block neighborhood. Estimates of the death toll range from dozens to 300. Billy Parker owns the Black Wall Street Market in Tulsa and says she was told to never discuss the massacre.
We had to hush up and never talked about.
Several events are planned for this week, including a visit by President Biden, who is expected to join local leaders in marking the occasion on Tuesday. And other events will feature the last 3 known living massacre survivors, who are all between 100 and 107 years old. I'm Mike Hempen.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. On May 24th of this year, 46-year-old Chinese Zhang Zhong scaled the tallest peak in the world, Mount Everest. Reuters' Jason Albano explains why the trek is remarkable.
Zhang Hong ascended to the peak of Mount Everest in total darkness. The Chinese mountaineer is now the first blind person in Asia and only the 3rd in the world to do so. But even when he made it to the top of the tallest peak in the world, he says his lack of sight kept him from celebrating too much.
到峰顶以后, When I got to the top, the sound of the wind was extremely scary. It was like a howl, so I was very scared. After reaching the peak, I didn't feel exhilarated or emotional like other climbers. I did not think too much, as I thought that the environment around me was quite risky, so I told my guide that I wanted to get down quickly.
The 46-year-old scaled the mountain from the Nepal side. He completed the almost 9,000-meter-high Himalayan feat on May 24th, along with three high-altitude guides, and returned to base camp just 3 days later.
No matter if you're disabled or normal, whether you have lost your eyesight or if you have no legs or hands, it doesn't matter. As long as you have a strong mind, you can always complete a thing that other people can't.
Jason Albano from Reuters. Videos of Navy pilots pursuing flying objects with amazing capabilities have struck a nerve in Washington. Matt Dibble looks at the latest UFO mystery.
When it comes to UFOs, U.S. officials are typically tight-lipped, but that is changing.
There's a whole fleet of them. Look on the ASA. My God.
In this video, taken from a U.S. Navy jet, we hear crew reacting to what appears to be a craft flying at high speed and in astonishing ways.
Well, if there's like this thing, it's rotating.
The video comes from a covert Pentagon task force established in 2007 and charged with collecting and analyzing encounters with what are now known as Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, or UAP. After three videos were leaked and posted online, the Pentagon confirmed in 2020 that they are authentic recordings made by Navy personnel. The disclosure has officials at the highest levels of government treating UFOs with a new urgency and openness, including former President Barack Obama, who had this to say on the Late Late Show with James Corden.
There's footage and records of objects in the skies that we don't know exactly what they are. We can't explain how they moved, their trajectory.
The Pentagon is expected to issue a report soon, providing Congress and the public with an analysis of UFO data from multiple government agencies. Senator Marco Rubio has championed the task force looking into the unidentified aerial phenomena. He talked to Fox Business.
There are things flying over national security installations. We don't know who they are. We don't know what it is. It isn't ours. We need to find out.
It's been 70 years since the Pentagon opened its first UFO study. In recent decades, there has been little official acknowledgement of the phenomenon, though sightings have continued. These cases are often researched by citizen groups. One of the oldest UFO organizations is the Center for the Study of UFOs, led by Mark Rodiger, who spoke with VOA via Skype.
We've been studying UFOs for all these years, and almost all of the evidence is witness testimony. You know, it's understandable. It's exciting. It convinced me years ago and still does, but it is just witness testimony. And you need something beyond that. That's why the Navy videos or all the data is so exciting.
One of the most prominent incidents took place off the coast of California. A U.S. aircraft carrier's radar began to pick up multiple craft moving in unusual ways. Two F-18 jets were sent to investigate. Both pilots and their crewmates described a 5-minute encounter with a cylindrical craft that one described as not behaving within the normal laws of physics. After the craft abruptly disappeared, it reappeared on radar 60 miles away. Determining if such objects pose a threat is the report's mandate. But some observers, like Mark Rodiger, hope the study will go even further in search of answers.
And that's really the point that those of us in the field have always said, is that there's a real phenomena. It deserves serious study.
Matt Dibble for VOA News.
And finally, Brighter Bridges is a London-based data-driven research firm focusing on Africa. The company says that the African edutech ecosystem is robust and Nigeria takes the lead. In Lagos, 9iJa Kids, an edutech company founded by three sisters, has developed an online and mobile platform that helps children ages 3 to 13 understand and retain knowledge using interactive fun games. For more, Africa 54's Paul Ndiho spoke to company co-founder Titi Adewusi via Skype.
Let's start up by you telling me a little bit about what you do and Niger Kids.
I'm one of the three female co-founders of Niger Kids. And what we simply do is we bring digital learning to children, but in a different kind of way. We make it fun. We all know that children love to play, and so we use play-based learning to help teach children anything. So we basically take anything and we say to ourselves, how do we gamify it? How do we make it fun? How do we make it exciting? So that children learn effortlessly. We want children to acquire skills, acquire knowledge in anything that they want to, but in a very fun and engaging way. So we do games, we do quizzes, we do worksheets. We've now also added doing interactive books, anything that will just make learning fun.
That's remarkable. How did you guys get started?
Honestly, it actually started with my son. So my younger son just was someone that just didn't like learning. Anytime it was time to do his school homework, any of those things, it was always one excuse or the other. Oh, mommy, I'm coming. I'm going to the restroom. Mommy, I'm coming. I think I'm tired. Oh, I think I'm hungry. A 20 minutes homework could end up taking us 3 hours. And then I came across a quote that said, if children don't learn the way you teach them, maybe you need to teach them the way they learn. And so I looked at him and said, you know what? He's very engaged when it comes to anything digital. So maybe what I can do is take some of this, his homework, take some of this, his content, and just make it digital, something that, you know, I can put in his device. And so I sat down with my co-founders, who are actually my sisters, and we sat down and said, okay, let's do this. And that's really how we started.
Interesting. I wish, looking back when I was a kid, I wish I had something like this. I think I would have turned out to be a better person. So what's the response been like? How are people responding to this initiative?
I think the feedback is the one that warms our hearts the most. You know, when you look at all our achievements, really the feedback. So there was a public school, a government-owned school that we used to take our devices to like once a week as part of our way to give back to the community. We go there with our devices, about 20 devices, go sit with the children for like an hour. Some days we do math, some days we do English, some days we do science. You know, the first feedback that we got from the principal of that school was that attendance was high on the days that we came. So they'll tell them, oh, you know what, if you're not well behaved today, I'm going to tell them they shouldn't come this week. And so, you know, like, no, we want them to come and play the games. And then the other thing we then saw was there was improvement. The teacher noted that they wanted to learn, because when they go back and play the game, they want to ensure that they do very well. So they were more, you know, ready to listen in class, just so that, you know, they can do well, you know, when they actually play the game. So it was just wonderful to hear that. And that was even before the pandemic. So suddenly EdTech became the forgotten child, is what I like to say. The forgotten child suddenly became the, you know, the prize and the favorite child. Suddenly everybody had no choice really but to move to technology, and they began to realize a lot of the things that they had left on the table. So we entered 2020 with a lot of people suddenly realizing that yes, you know, they needed to embrace online learning. It gave them a lot more opportunity, but they also realized something, that online learning is tough.
How about in terms of content development? You said that you love doing that. Are you developing all the content yourselves?
We currently develop all the content ourselves. So we are made up of, you know, educators as well in our team that develop the content, review the content. We also have kids that help provide the content, you know. So in 2020, we started doing short stories. So we have quite a number of kids that wrote the short stories, and they were all excited to see their short stories being published on our platform. We get ideas from the children in terms of developing the content. Even when we do develop the content, we do the initial testing with a group of students. Say, oh, what do you like about this game? They'll tell you, oh, you should have done this, you didn't do that. So but all the content is actually developed here locally.
Thank you so much, Tati, for your time.
Thank you so much, Paul, for having me.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.